I did forget to announce one thing. If you are a mom here tonight, we have something for you after the service that we want to give you. So before you leave, don't leave without your gift. So, that's a serious thing. Yeah. For half a second, just enough time, huh? Sure. We're here, quick story. How propaganda like that spreads is beyond me. Just the first two people who had that discussion. It's like, did you just make that up? No. Heard it from a priest. It's true. So if you guys will turn to Isaiah 2, we'll get started. I didn't give you Isaiah 2. I know I'm terrible. There's a couple of verses later on I was like, and there was that one. One of the things we've been studying in the school that I go to, I'll start there, is what's called kingdom theology. That's sort of the buzzword or the coined term for the teaching of what we do here on earth and what the commission that Jesus brought in his message and the results of that we see sort of in the end times, or the results of that when things are finally settled and we go to heaven and New Jerusalem comes to earth, the sort of ramifications of our actions. It's sort of like this whole school of thought where we often, in class, they teach several classes on it, and there are sort of discussion-based groups that kind of sit down and kind of go over it, like really sort of looking, taking apart scripture and really kind of researching a lot of that. And what it has created in me, and I think in many who I've kind of, you know, some of you guys as I've hung out with you or we've just sort of talked about it, has sort of created a divide between, I think, what most Western Christians view heaven to be like and therefore our role here on earth versus what might be traditionally thought, right? You know, we kind of joke around and say heaven has clouds, and there are angels, and we're wearing white robes, and everyone has harps. There's sort of like that thing that we sort of, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, you know, you go to that light, and then, you know, you've always seen Hollywood sort of mocking or mimicking it, you know, and sort of joking around about what we sort of collectively have endorsed in our culture, what heaven is like. Which has sort of, I think, created a schism for what Scripture actually teaches. And it's funny because we recognize in a lot of ways that wherever we think we're headed, especially when we're on a road trip, wherever we think we're going, we tend to prep and we tend to plan in whatever that direction is, right? If we're driving, well, we better fill up, you know, the car, better check our oil, you know, make sure our tires are rotated, whatever we got to do. When we expect a long journey, and then we're depending on where we expect to go, we tend to prep in that direction. So for some of us, if we're going to some place that's cold, we might bring jackets with us because when we arrive there, we don't want to be cold. If we're going someplace warm or someplace hot, maybe a vacation, we bring, you know, clothes that aren't as heavy, that aren't as thick. We sort of plan for our journey, but we plan for the destination we're going. And of course, you know, I think in a simplistic way we could look at heaven and hell being that difference. But we don't always look at what we believe as heaven will be like, we sort of prep for. If we think we're just going to sit around and not do much, well, then we may not worry about what we will have to actually do once we get there. But if we knew heaven was like, I don't know why I'm using this example, baseball, I don't know, then how, and that we were going to play baseball for eternity. I am not a baseball fan, so not propagating anything there. But then we might practice our swing. We might practice our pitching. We want to be the best baseball players that we're going to be when we arrive there. right? We sort of plan and think towards what we anticipate and what we expect. And sort of in Western Christianity, we have created almost a belief of how inactive we might be in heaven, right? There's not as much actions or roles we're going to play, expectations maybe, that are going to be there. We have a difficult time imagining it, and then we have a much more difficult time responding to, you know, what we anticipate and expect. But truthfully, Scripture describes, I think, heaven and hell a lot more literal and physical and involving a lot of activity than we tend to sort of acknowledge. You know, and many writers have sort of tried to draw those conclusions and figure out what those things are. One particular book that I'm reading, more out of exploration of just sort of the ideas, and maybe not so much for what this person's known for, but Rob Bell's book, Love Wins. That sort of one that most people are like, oh, you know, that was all over Charisma magazine when it first published. He was all over, you know, the news, and people were interviewing him because he sort of said, I want to flesh out what I think this looks like. And it went against a lot of the mainstream beliefs of modern Christianity, both good and bad. Both good and bad. And so as I'm reading his book, he spends the first third of the book trying to really dive into, the Jewish thinking, what was believed in the Old Testament, how did people view the scriptures and their expectation of what heaven would be like, and then using that as a backdrop to Jesus' teaching. So when Jesus taught, what did they hear? What did they envision? Versus what we might hear and what we might envision. I have a hard time sometimes imagining a city gate as it's described in Revelation. Where's Melbourne's gate? Is it 95? Do we have an archway, you know, that we sort of like drive into? Maybe I missed it. So is it on US 1? Historic downtown has one. There we go. So historic, you know, we don't have walls around our city. So like that's kind of weird, you know, like when you're looking at New Jerusalem and you see sort of the dimensions and there are walls and there are 12 gates and there are these colors. And we look at our modern culture and we're like, well, that's a bit limiting, isn't it? You know, to be the guy living right next to a wall, you know, and we recognize that there's the literal realities of what we read and there's the figurative realities, but we recognize that there is some literal, that there's some physicality to this, that I think sometimes we bypass in our perspective of what we view heaven. And I want to look at a couple verses in the Old Testament to use it as a backdrop of a lot of Jesus' teaching, because I think that directly how we view heaven and how we view our arrival and what we expect to do there directly affects how we engage in our culture and society now. Right? When you start your own business, you expect to make a certain amount. You start with a business plan. You anticipate a certain future that you prepare and build for. We have an entire education system that's designed that way. You go to school at a certain age, you're taught things at certain stages to prep you for something in the future. I mean, I can't tell you how many times in high school we were told, you know, when you're in college, you're not going to be chased down for your homework. If you don't turn it in, you don't turn it in. No one's going to, you know, remind you. I remember hearing that so much that my first year at BCC, I was terrified that I was going to miss something on my syllabus. Like I misunderstood something. So I was asking very obvious questions like, okay, so when you say it's due October 22nd, you actually mean October 22nd? You know, when the class starts or when the class ends? Like, what would be the marker for when it has to be turned in? You know, what if this happens? Like, I was like, I genuinely was sort of, okay, I remember what I was told. You're not going to chase me down. You're really not chasing me for this. Like, I want you to hold me accountable to turning in this. Can I get a reminder email? I distinctly remember being in an American history class with this girl who was always late, like always late, every class. And the teacher didn't really mind it as much. He was very like, hey, you're adults, come and go as sort of you choose. And so she would always show up, but she was frantic when she would arrive. So she's digging through her bag, and of course it's loud, you know? And so she's pulling out pens, dropping pens, knocking over her water bottle, just trying to get herself settled. And I remember the day of our final, she had overslept. Yeah. And so she oversleeps. The teacher keeps looking at me. He was a really cool guy. And he's just like, where is she? You know, like, are you not your sister's keeper? And I was like, I don't know. You know, like, I don't. And so we were expecting her to, like, run through those doors, frantic, you know, as always. You know, it was just sort of, but she wasn't showing up. And I remember, you know, after class, he said, why don't you give her a call and see where she's at? Maybe she's in the parking lot. I'll show some grace and we'll kind of figure this thing out. I give her a call and she's like, I'm at home. She's like, I realized I was late, and I figured what was the point of showing up? I failed the class. You know, that's it. And I was like, well, he's standing here, and he's saying that if you can show up, you know, so, you know, he'll accept your exam. And he did. He met her in the library. He was a really gracious guy. She passed the class. Like, it was awesome. But it was interesting to see sort of how she prepared and her expectation of what that was going to look like, her college experience versus maybe mine or someone else's. She was responding differently to it. She didn't expect that by showing up late in the for the final that she would be shown any kind of grace. So she didn't bother to try. Upon hearing him say, no, I'll accept your grade if you'll just show up and turn it in, you know, suddenly she's in the car, she's driving, she's making her way there. And so we sort of have a society where we understand what we expect allows us to prep for where we're headed and what we plan on doing. Yet it's interesting that sort of when we sort of view heaven or sort of our eternal destination, much less, we don't flesh it out. We don't really have an idea or an opinion of what that looks like. So our lives almost reflect that very thing. You sort of read a lot of surveys and a lot of the differences between Western Christianity and maybe Eastern Christianity. There's a lot of differences, and one of them being we tend to be much more laid back. You know, especially during, you know, a lot of the teachings and expectation of, like, the rapture. It was just sort of, hey, all right, the rapture's coming, so we're just going to wait for it. We're just going to live holy until that day. We're going to be pulled out of it. How many people did not invest in the marketplace expecting? I remember that 88 Reasons Why the World's Going to End in 1988 for some of our dated friends here tonight. I love you guys. We love you guys. We love you guys. We make that joke because there's grace. And then the year after, they did 89 reasons. And the year after, they did 89 reasons why the world's going to end in 1989. And that was also a bestseller. I would have thought that after the first book, the writer's accreditation would have plummeted, but it sold just as well. People were worried. They were scared. They wanted to know the signs, and the people began to disengage from society. Last week, I talked about how I met with a Christian economist. All right. Thank you, buddy. I appreciate you. And he was talking about how he travels and speaks with pastors and does these seminars for Christians. And he says that Christians are the largest demographic that does not invest financially in the things around them because they have a fear of what's next and an expectation of leaving. And he was just describing how he sees the finances go into the hands of the unrighteous because the righteous doesn't want to get involved. There's a disengaging. I use the example of how he was explaining that many Americans fear our economy collapsing while a lot of foreign companies keep buying stock in American in American commerce because they don't see that at all. They see us as sort of a financial powerhouse, so they invest in our nation. Last week I mentioned how Singapore, which is the third largest city in terms of the exchange of commerce, has the Prime Minister of Finances had said during a press release that Singapore has more faith and confidence in the American economy than most Americans do. So they continue to lend in America and invest in America. They're sort of, and so he explains, he's like, I see these figures, I see these numbers. And so he says, you see a disengaging from sort of Christians. And in a lot of ways, we have built a society that's largely like that. One generation after another, with the expectation of the world's gonna end tomorrow, I don't get involved as much, we sort of built a culture around that. So we just sort of kind of, our attitude is to wait, right? Don't get too involved, let's just wait. Let's not invest, let's not build. But I do believe Scripture really speaks largely not only against that attitude, but even provides reasons why we would want to be involved, why heaven is physical, why our actions today affect our eternity and affect what we expect to happen then. So Isaiah 2, verse 2 through 5, I'm going to read through really quick. And here you see an example of what they expected the last days to be like, what they anticipated, you know, sort of God finalizing everything, what they expected to witness and experience. And if you were here a couple weeks ago, I quoted Isaiah 2. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills. In Revelation, you read the temple of God multiple times being mentioned. It will be exalted above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. So nations are involved. They're being drawn in. There are physical people arriving. And it says all the nations will be here. All the nations. So there's a mass gathering of people of different languages, different ethnic groups, different, all coming together to this mountain. And many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways so that we will walk in his path. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations. He will settle disputes for many peoples. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned there's a settling of disputes and arguments. There's a settling of he becomes the ultimate judge saying, I will handle these affairs. So all affairs are being addressed. That might be bad for a lot of career judges out there. Like, so my gavel won't be used anymore. And it says, he will judge between the nations. He will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares. So weapons of warfare being used for cultivation, which is interesting. It doesn't say they will throw away their sword because we have nothing to do with metal, weapons, or anything like that. It says, no, they will take it for one purpose and make it for another. They will refashion it to produce something else. Plowshares. Why would you need plowshares? Unless they expected to farm. Unless they anticipated agriculture to be an aspect of what their life will be like, that they will no longer go to war, but they'll continue to cultivate their land. It's almost like speaking again of sort of Adam's commission to expand the garden, to name the animals. There's sort of a reinstitution of that again, like, hey, don't throw them away. Make them into plowshares. And it continues and it says, and their spears into pruning hooks. Again, reinforcing that idea of going, hey, you won't need spears, but you will need pruning hooks because there'll be a harvest and you'll need to gather food. Nations will not take up sword against nations, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, and let us walk in the light of the Lord. It is hard for us to imagine a world without war or no military. And in the next set of verses we will read in Isaiah 11, it mentions that they will not. I'm sorry, it's in this verse. It says they will not train for war anymore. So you won't have a military. You won't have boot camp. Those are things that we sort of all kind of conceptualize. Yeah, we don't envision war being involved at the end. But yet, it speaks of production and involvement. It speaks of agriculture. For a society that, I mean, that'd be weird for us, right? Like, agriculture? I mean, I got a raised bed at home. I've never used a pruning hook in my life. You know, like, how will I know how to use a plow? I've never plowed before, you know? But the principle remains the same, that for these Jews who were reading the book of Isaiah, that were reading this, they're looking at not in our future we will be inactive. They're saying, no, the strategy for when he returns is going to be calibrated to the way he sets things up. But we will be involved in something. I noticed it didn't talk about harps and wings where we sit on a cloud and lounge all day. You know, it speaks of something a little bit different. What's interesting is you see this in Joel chapter 3, verse 2. You see the reverse. It says, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weakling say, I am strong. There was an expectation of judgment. And so the prophet was declaring, hey, you're going to need those spears. You're going to need that sword. In Isaiah, which is who's speaking about an end times realm, is saying, okay, you won't need the swords and spears. You're going to make it into something else. But the language continues to be used on what is being laid out in their expected future. And one, obviously, Joel speaking of something that occurred a lot sooner versus Isaiah. Isaiah 11 says, we will not judge by what we see, what he sees with his eyes, or decides by what he hears from his ears. And it continues in verse 4. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. So again, you have a righteous judge. He's executing justice. He's making sure that the concerns of the needy are heard, which for us, we look at God and we go, that is a character of who he is. He hears our cries, but this is being reinforced in Isaiah. He hasn't forgotten your plight. Those of you who are wrongfully imprisoned, he has not forgotten you. He will make this right. So there will be justice. And it continues and it says, the wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion, and the yearling together. There are animals. I mean, I have people ask me all the time, do you think there's animals in heaven? Yes. I mean, the lion and the lamb are going to lie down together, right? Like what? They're just going to disappear? Like that's just like this random, they get raptured somewhere else? Like what is the, there are animals and they will, and there's safety among them, right? When we think of, and I kind of laugh at that set of verses because it's like, when we think of a dangerous animal, we sort of look at like their purpose is to like just kill stuff, right? Like when you hear someone, he was petting a lion and he got mauled by it. Well, you're not supposed to pet lions. You know, like that's what they do. That's what they're designed for apparently is to kill people, you know? But when you think of a cow, you think, oh, milk, you know? When you think of cattle, you think meat. You think, oh no, these animals produce something. Imagine what the purpose of these animals are where there is no death. In the Garden of Eden, what purpose did they serve, you know? In our established society, fallen world, we design what that looks like. Elephants go into the circus, you know, unless you live in Thailand, then you worship them. Cows in Texas get eaten, unless you're living in India, they get worshipped. You know, like it's sort of like we funnel what goes where. And there are times, you know, I was having a discussion with someone a couple days ago. I'm like, man, that really sucks for elephants to be in a zoo. Like, you know, in some ways, right? I get that there are those who are injured and they kind of bring them into a safe environment. But in the case of things that are captured in the wild and brought into the circus, like your life, if you ever seen Dumbo, I saw it as a kid and I totally forgot about that movie. Rightfully so. And then I watch it as an adult with my daughter. I'm like, oh my God. Like this is terrible. We're not going to the zoo again. No more circus. Ringley Brothers is going to get sued. Like, we're done. Forget SeaWorld. Like, we're just shutting this whole animal situation down. I mean, that was sort of after watching Dumbo, we're like, this is terrible. But we recognize that these animals sort of aren't purposed to be in these environments. They're made for them so that we can sort of interact with them. But we anticipate that when we think of a lion, they should be in the woods somewhere doing lions or in the Africa somewhere doing lion things. When we envision tigers, they should be doing tiger things. Here at the in Isaiah 11, we see it laid out. It just goes into how these animals will interact. Yet we question the idea, are there animals? Yes, there are. There's a purpose for them. Maybe for a Jew at that time, they would go, good, because I really need that lamb, because I need more wool. I would be concerned if there aren't any animals. How will I till the soil without cattle? How will I? The cow will feed. Oh, and then it says, and a little child will lead them. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And a little child will lead them. What? Why is there a child leading them? You know, it's like, is it a parade? What is the involvement here? But again, you see that continued illustration of interaction with animals, with kids having some involvement with them. Yes, it speaks figuratively of peace and no more conflict, even in the natural. But that language, I think, for a Jew that's thinking in the physical, we anticipate and expect that some of this is true. Right? We expect that, you know, we will need pruning hooks. And it continues and says, the cow will feed with the bear, the young will lie down together, the lion will eat straw like an ox. Again, sort of that what we sort of envision the Garden of Eden looking like. The infant will play near the cobra's den. Sorry. The young will put its hand into the viper's nest. Why? Those are the questions I ask myself. Like, I think I would still have a natural fear. Like, I understand there's no war, but let's just stay away from the viper's den. Let's give it a few years in heaven with proven facts and historical evidence that there hasn't been a documented viper attack on a child before we really start playing with them. And so you see that language being used in the Old Testament, that backdrop, I think, in a first century Jew's mind when he meets Jesus and hears him teach and preach about what the kingdom of heaven is like, about what the kingdom of God is like, what we expect in our future, what we expect in the end times. I think all of that sort of is part of that aspect. They don't think like, I can't imagine that they go, oh, we're just kind of going to go to heaven and drink wine and play the harp all day. Like, I don't think that was, you know, what they would have envisioned and thought it would be like. And then if you guys will turn to Matthew 25, I want to look at a couple parables of Jesus illustrating our actions and how it affects our eternal destination, but also the ramifications of our choices, which I think makes a lot more sense when you're envisioning heaven as a physical place, right? I think his parables kind of make, like, take on a greater, with maybe the gravitas, a greater sort of weight to it when we envision, no, there will be physical cities, there will be gold, there will be sort of exchange, there will be something. And it says, starting in right before Matthew 25, we're going to read verse 14 through 30. The set of verses or the parable that Jesus speaks of before this is about the wise virgins and the foolish ones. And so before he gets into this parable, he's already explained to them about the difference between those who will choose to wait for the Lord and will use wisdom and gather up oil for that long wait and the results that they will see, and those who were foolish and said, no, he'll get here in no time, you know, we'll be out of here and we don't have to be involved much longer, and sort of the results of that. And so already the listener, the person sitting there listening to Jesus teach, is thinking this way. Okay, well, I obviously want to be wise, right? You know, I want to go into the banqueting feast. Like, I want to. I see that illustration continually used. You know, there'll be a banquet, there'll be a wedding feast. We kind of use that. And I kind of joke around. I'm like, how do we anticipate to eat anything if we don't think it's a physical place? Like, how many Christians will be shocked? There's an actual wedding feast. That's amazing. My hand isn't going through stuff. I'm a corporeal creature. Like, we can touch things. Like, we can drink. You want to try this? This is good wine. Like, you know, a couple weeks ago, I mentioned that the term a new wine, you know, is constantly used throughout the Old Testament. Again, sort of that idea of earth plus, better than what we have. So Matthew 25, it talks about, of course, as you guys have read, it talks about the talents, the bag. In the NIV, it says bags of gold, and it talks about the master who gave 10 bags, 5 bags. Oh, I'm sorry, 5, 2, and did I say that right? And 1. And at the beginning, it says that when he's distributing this gold, he gives it according to their ability, which is interesting. He doesn't, like, randomly hand out money and says, all right, well, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, you get 10, you get 5, you get 2, you get 1. No, it says, each according to his ability, his proven effort during my service, I will grant 5, 2, and 1 going down the line. And then in the servant that buried his gold and didn't invest it, it's interesting to see his response, and I'll just, for the sake of time, I'll have you guys just sort of read that on your own, but you read later on, I think it's in verse 29, when he's talking about, when he's responding to the master as to why he didn't invest, he uses the word hard. I knew you were a hard man. In the Aramaic, that word is steadfast or unyielding. I knew you were set in the what you expected of us. And he's like, and I knew you were unyielding, so I just didn't want to get involved. Where the other said, I knew what you expected of me, and I did get involved. And according to my ability, I spent the time that you were gone producing something. And what is the response? And you can read the same sort of story in Luke. What is the response of the master? He doesn't say, hey, good job. Here's your harp. Go float on a cloud. He says, you get more gold to continue your investments. The reward system is proportionate to their ability and what they've produced and the expectation of what they will produce. What does that look like for us now? It's almost like we see this God as a really, really bad at giving gifts, right? Like, you know, kind of like we sort of anticipate that our reward for life will be these like useless things, right? I'm floating around in a harp. What could you give me? A nicer harp? Like, what? But each of this is based on investment, right? So to the person who is really good at investing finances, I want to reward that and give you more. Like, you're awesome at that. That's your calling. That's your purpose. That's what I've drawn you to. I want to add and increase what you have and what your purposes and callings are, right? Again, very difficult for us to imagine to go, what do you mean we will have stuff? I think we look at the verses in Revelation where it talks about the kings casting their crown on the floor. I don't think that's a limitation of God's reward system. We'll all get a bunch of crowns that we're just going to throw on the ground anyway. It's like we serve a God who gives good gifts, right? We serve a God who increases the work of our hands, right? We serve a God that we want to glorify in all of our actions and in all that we do. And I'm not going to pretend to know how many, you know, okay, well, if we have a bunch of Christian, you know, financial corporations, then we'll have 10 of them in heaven. I won't go into that sort of illustration of the specifics of what that looks like, but there's certainly a response in our faithfulness, in our individual abilities, and how we invest that in the kingdom of God, and the continual expectation of what that will look like in the future. Not a, well, we're just waiting to get out of here and I will be done with this. As much as it's, no, this is mine, and I glorify him with it, and will continue to glorify him with it, right? To a musician, you know, the idea of a harp, maybe not a harp, maybe a keyboard, and continually doing the passion that God has invested and instilled with them takes on a greater light if the idea is like, okay, heaven is going to be me continuing to write this awesome music and continue this awesome fellowship with God, and my expression of his love will go on. Like, he designed me to be a certain way, and I get to continue in that expression and honor and glorifying them. You know, to them, the idea of continual music being played before the Lord and their involvement with that is the greatest reward ever. Dropping the best mixtape for the Lord, you know, becomes like, this is awesome, right? Whereas maybe to you and I, some of you are musicians, maybe to the person who's really into agriculture, they're like, no, I want to continue producing that stuff. I want bigger carrots, you know, bigger potatoes. I just want to produce and produce all the more. I think there's sort of, again, this expectation of your ability, your individual calling being invested in by God on this side of eternity, and that continual investment of what that looked like, or that expectation of that investment. Lastly, it says, for whoever has been given more, and they will have an abundance, and those that do not have, even what they have, will be taken away. Again, there's exchange, and those exchanges carry meaning, right? If there's nothing but just sitting around, then why does it matter how much gold you and I have? You know, and of course, gold isn't the purpose, but the idea of our abilities being exercised. In the parable of the tenants in Matthew 21, the tenants that took care of the vineyard. Did I say that right? Okay. In the parable of the tenants, right before in Matthew 21, I thought I like mispronounced it, so I was like, did I say that? 5 minutes ago, I said something different. Oh, no worry. Rewind. I can start again. I don't mind. Are you guys cool with that? It's already 7:30. You were like, tenants, talents? It's a T word. back up the play 5 minutes. So in Matthew 21, starting at verse 33, you have the parable of the tenants. Of course, before we get into that, the previous parable was the one about I'm sorry, after this one, what you hear the parable of the sheep and the goats, the division between the faithful ones and those who were unfaithful. So it's sort of a leading into. Jesus uses this parable as a backdrop to later on at that day of judgment, his division between those who responded according to his investment in them and those who had chosen differently. And it says, and again, I encourage you guys to read this story, but in Matthew 21, you see Jesus in this parable is talking about these servants showing up or Jesus lending this vineyard to this group of people and that it was their job to take care of it. And when the time came, he wanted a piece of the produce from that vineyard. There was an expectation of a harvest, and when that harvest came, he expected something to be shown. I want to see something. Right? You see that in every one of these parables, I want to see something. In all of this investing and in all of your involvement, what do you have? Like what have you produced? You know? I think that's why suddenly calling and purpose takes on a whole new meaning. Because if you choose to live a lifestyle with no purpose, if you choose to live a life where you don't involve yourself in your calling or what you're expected to produce, you kind of sort of live like, well, none of this will matter in the end anyway. No, it will. It will. You chose to bury your talent and not get involved. You know, you chose to versus the expectation of what was produced from this. And so in this parable, it talks about the king who sends, who creates his vineyard. He lends it out to these tenants, and the day of harvest comes. And so he sends his servant and he says, hey, you know, the king would like, you know, his cut of all this. And they go, no, forget that guy. Like, he doesn't get a cut. Like, we're not using this for that purpose. And then he sends another servant, another servant, another servant. And finally, he sends his son with the expectation that surely they'll hear my son and they'll respond to him. And so the parable ends with these guys in this vineyard chasing the son out, killing the son, and then sort of the aftermath of that parable, sort of the judgment that kind of came from that. And he directly speaks to the Pharisees at this point. And they know what he's talking about. They know there was something expected of us, and you sent the prophets to speak and say something and say, guys, there's a purpose to this. We're supposed to reap something. What have you done? What have you produced? And the continual rejection of these, and then God saying, fine, I'll send my son. Surely they will listen to him. And sort of the aftermath effect of that. So the Pharisees are kind of listening to this story and going, okay, this is not good. Like, even though they're literally hearing Jesus say in this story that the son will be killed and those who kill the son will be in judgment, they still chose to plot against the son and say, no, we'll silence this guy and we'll end it. And so it was speaking of the purpose of the people of Israel, who they were supposed to be, what was expected of them, what their calling and their purpose was supposed to be. In Exodus, Exodus 19:6, God says to Moses and to the people of Israel, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. I have purpose for you. It's going to be awesome. You will be a holy people, righteous and just. You will be a royal priesthood. You will live as priest for the nations. They will come to you and they will know about me. You see, Jesus didn't invent evangelism. It was already in the Old Testament. The concept was already laid there. You just had a people who weren't very active in it. You just had a people that seemed to be a little bit more, you know, seclusive and kind of sort of pulling away from the culture than really bringing people in to know this God. You continue to see throughout Isaiah and Jeremiah the talk of the nations will come to Israel. And my righteousness will be known. This God who says, I want to be known among the nations. And a people that sort of close up their ears and go, no, we just want to be blessed by you and hang on until you wrap this whole thing up. And he's like, no. No, not at all. My desire is for the entire, and even though Israel had a priesthood among one of their tribes, the Levites, he still expected the people as a whole to be a priesthood to the world, to represent who he was. to respond in kind to his heart to the Gentile nations. And Peter uses this very same illustration in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. He says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praise of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." Peter uses the same illustration and says, guys, the calling's the same. Are we going to do it this time? Are we going to get involved? Are we going to go out there? Will we be a royal priesthood to the world? Will we choose to be a holy nation? Will we be a holy people that respond to his calling and who we're supposed to be? And you continually hear, you know, Paul and Peter and the early apostles encouraging the church, saying, continue to produce good fruit. Your reward's coming. Your reward's coming. Keep at it. You're doing great. Keep going. He's coming. It's going to be awesome. You know, do not grow weary of doing good. Like, we're getting there. He's seeing these people rise up and walk into their destiny, into their individual calling and their individual ability, and walking into that light. In Luke 19, it talks about cities. You know, you have sort of the same idea of the parable of the talents, but it talks about to this one man, you know, who was faithful, he'll get 10 cities, and to this other guy's 5 cities. The illustration I would personally add to that, I think I said it a couple weeks ago, in the movie Troy. If you guys saw the movie Troy, when all the ships from Greece, all the armies of all the Greek city-states. All the ships of the city-states were coming in, and everybody's eager to hit the beach and receive their reward. And after the first few days of just sort of gaining a beachhead, you see the King Agamemnon gathering sort of these warriors who did well, and he's like, and they're all giving him, you know, some spoils of war. I got this from their main captain. It's his shield. He's dead now. You know, oh, well, I've got his earrings, you know. Like, and everyone's just sort of like, here's what I've gathered. Here's what I've produced. And to each one, Agamemnon's like, yes, you will dine with me in the halls of Troy. And you will carry my wine cup. You'll like it, you know, like, and he's distributing to these guys, like, yes, let's keep going. We will rejoice together when we finally conquer Troy, and each of you will get your cut. Good job, like, well done. You sort of see that response, and sort of, I envision when I read Luke 19, God going, awesome, you will get 10 cities. I hope you're good at administration. We'll get you someone. You will get 5. You're not so good at it. But we'll figure this out, you know. And you will get 2 cities. And you, not so much. You're the janitor. And you will get, you know, it's sort of a response to these people operating in their calling and who he is. I think it's a removal from the focus being about conquering sin. And accepting that he took care of that, to free us up into walking into our destiny. But so many of us are still stuck on the conquering sin part. We become sort of inward focused. We make an idol of our struggles. It's all about dealing with our own struggles. And don't get me wrong, like, when we fall, when we mess up, it can be crippling emotionally, spiritually. We can just sort of like fall into that place. But it's the attitude of get up. You have a calling and a purpose. I've taken care of that for a reason and a purpose. It's sort of a refocusing, but we sort of just kind of get stuck there, right? Like, oh, my sins, the travesty of what I've done, you know? And Jesus is like, all right, I've taken care of that. You've got my Holy Spirit, don't waste time, you know? And it's like, no, today I mourn. And God's saying, no, today you move. You know, we're going to move forward into sort of a lot of this. And again, you see that image of that reestablishing. So, I mean, we see in Revelation, there's talk of, again, more of that physical being described, of New Jerusalem coming down, of heaven and earth coming together, of Jesus restoring things again, of things being established, things being made right. Even Jerusalem, again, like I mentioned before, has dimensions and walls and cities, and there's gold on the ground. Like, so we're walking? Like, okay, you know, like, to me, I look at that and they're like, all right, so I won't have a hovercraft that I will just sort of lazily ride on and never walk again. You know, like, it's like, no, there's an intention, there's an expectation. It talks about worshiping him, being like him. It talks about judging angels during certain parts. So again, it's sort of that idea of your actions, your service, they matter, they mean something. It talks about the honoring of people who choose faithfulness. And it talks about that on more than just a religious level, right? I don't hear a lot of talk about church services as much, you know? And you will preach in front of a church of 10,000 people. And you will preach in front of a church of 5,000. And you get a small church, you know, you're not so good at this. And you will hold 2 worship services. You don't see a distribution that looks like that. And you will be on 4 boards. Yep, 4 boards of churches, and you'll handle their children's ministry. And you don't see that. Like, that isn't the language. It isn't, hey, how can we produce more a Christian church culture? And no, the language is things that actually involve our scenery and our realm around us. It actually involves what we are physically do on a regular basis. I was having a conversation with someone, and the question was asked, if you envision what you expect a Christian's calling is supposed to be, if you envision, like, what are you building towards? And my response was, not Joyce Meyer's ministry, not Joel Osteen's ministry. Like, I do not want to, you know, and many of you guys I know feel the same sentiment. We do not want a big church building like that to us. When I envision, what is the arrival point? You know, like, what is the successful point? When a band thinks, like, we want to go triple platinum, we want to write music until we're old, we want to tour the world, like, you sort of, what is that end goal? To me, it's not some big platform lights and all that stuff. I'm like, I want an empire. Yeah, like megalomaniac, you know, like that's there. I'm like, I don't envision the church, you know, Christians and all of us sort of being uninvolved with the world and just sort of gathering together and holding a bunch of church services and that's us arriving. Not at all. I envision an empire. I envision each people that I work with being God, rewarding them for their actions, their talents, their ability, for their faithfulness, adding to what they have been faithful with over and over again. My expectation is to see Travis run 15 web design companies and Chris to be the culinary teacher of all Brevard County. You know, like, I envision, like, I don't know, whatever. For Jordan to own 1 million cars and Mac products, maybe even be on the board of Mac. For Ashley to have 20 Etsy shops underneath her. You know, for Stu to have 15 nightclubs with art and Portland under him. I don't know. Like, I envision sort of like more of what our individual destinies and calling is and our influence expanding, not retracting as we just draw close in and towards each other. I see a spreading out where the borders of Brevard County are exceeded and we're now across Central Florida and all of Florida, then the Southeast, then people are scared because we're becoming a problem, you know? And sort of the expansion in whatever individual calling is, I don't picture a larger service. It just doesn't, I don't see that. Yes, I see we worship him. Yes, I see we stand before him. I'm not saying like that isn't an aspect of it. But as I mentioned a few months back, that whole Lance Wallnau spheres of influence, I told the story about how there's a teacher and preacher named Lance Wallnau that talks about the 7 spheres of influence that exists in every nation. And some of you guys, feel free to tune me out. Especially those who have heard it 1,500 times. And in Lance Wallnau's example, he talks about it's these spheres of influence. If a people group can infiltrate and be at the center of all 7 or reach the summit of these spheres of influence, they can control a nation. They can influence the direction of something. And that's the 7 are business, arts, media, education, family, religion, or Christianity in our example, and government. And he says, as Christians, we do a very good job going up the mountain summit. We do, the religion one, Christianity. We've got like Christianity pegged in the U.S. Like it's a brand name. We have Christian bookstores. We have Christian business. Like we've got that sort of, you know, Christianity's established. But the other 6 are questionable. Very questionable. Like, are we really leading in education? business, arts, enterprise? Is that really something we're doing well in? Because in our culture, we remove ourselves from the other six and we involve ourselves in the seventh, and we call that one holy. This one's holy and righteous and just. The other ones are a waste of time. Yet we see a God that goes, no, I'm in agriculture. I'm in government. I want it all. Like, I want to build an empire, a holy nation, a holy people. I want to be involved in all of it. I want my gospel to be preached in every sphere of influence. It's like, how do we anticipate having righteous government leaders when we don't believe we're supposed to go up that one? Or having righteous businessmen and women leading, you know, enterprise in our county when we don't believe we should be involved in that. We've sort of discouraged that. That's not encouraged. That's not, you know, education. Like, as much, maybe we have homeschooling down, right? But public schools, no, burn them down. You know, no more public schools. You know, like, no involvement in any of that. A removal away from those things. And it's like, does God really view our nation and the nations of the earth and go, this is what I wanted. Disengagement. Thank you. That's your gift. I'll put that up here. Or that when he arrives, you have kings going, here are the nations I ruled righteously. Here are the companies that I improved according to your name, and I took care of the poor and my employees. I did right by them. You know, here are the schools that we started. Here are the nonprofits that we helped to fill in those gaps of needs. Like, that people will come from all over the nations with gifts going, here, here, here. We brought these to you. We did what you asked. We were involved in all of these things. Our involvement mattered. And again, I don't see God going, good job, here's a harp, go float. I see him going, awesome, here's 10 more schools. Here are 5 more nations. Here's 12 more businesses. Continue my reign. Well done. Well done. You have purpose. You love this, right? Cool. Keep doing it. You know, like, I love that you love it. I made you to love it. This is awesome. I'm glad you know that I love this. Keep doing that. And of course, that's, you know, some of these things are a little bit difficult, you know, right? Like, for someone who's a security guard, maybe, they're like, so I'll have more prisoners to guard? Like, I don't want that. Like, I don't want crime. I thought that ended. Sure, there's some aspects of culture and society that won't play a role at the end. But I think for so many of us, huh? Does he get a harp? Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you just get a harp. You get half a harp. You complained. Like, I was going to give you 12 prisons. Never mind. I think there's a level of involvement that I think we need to see beyond. We need to sort of see beyond. I think there's something to be said about, I'll be careful saying this. Yeah, everyone's like, just don't say it. I can understand the appeal of many pagan cultures that celebrated conquest and war, believing that their eternal destination was to continue conquering and fighting. Like, they didn't see we did nothing. They see the thing we honor as most in our culture will have a role in our expanse, in our eternal future. I think there's something to be said about that, the acknowledgement of we're not building to be lazy and just retire. It's like, no, there's life in what we do and a celebration of who he is. It is worship to teach those kids. It is worship to do well by your business. It is worship to do well by your nonprofits. And to see a culture that actually celebrates that and enforces people, or, you know, reinforces support for people who are seeing that way, I think requires a shift in what we view our eternal destination to look like. Because you will begin to mimic where you think you're going to end up. You will plan for that. For people who want to retire at a certain age, they will put money away. For people who don't want to think about that right now, they'll just continue to spend and live. You know, there's a response in how we envision and we imagine things to be. I think that should allow us to just ignite our creativity and say, what did you make me for? What can I honor you with? I think there's something exciting to say about that. God has called you to a purpose. You all have purpose. Unemployment forever is not what's expected of you. You know, doing nothing, hiding your dream and burying it, like, will have an eternal consequence versus no, do what you have been called to do And let's celebrate that. And I think we'll begin to see a holy nation. And I think about that sometimes, man. I'm like, if I view God as wanting to, all Christians to climb the summit of business and summit of government, is there a government that I can think of in this world that actually is ran by righteous Christians and led by them? And if there isn't, and we could only think of one or two, isn't that a problem? Does he just not want to be involved in administrating righteousness from a government level? Like, does he just want corrupt kings? That's like, I just want a bunch of corrupt kings, you know, doing evil across the land. Isn't there something to be said? I think of the picture of the Davidic kingdom and God's covenant with David, saying like, man, that was a golden era of Israel. And David was involved in worship and reestablishing the tabernacle, warfare and going to war, commerce and helping with finances. He thought circumspectly, like, if I'm going to be these people's shepherd, I have to help provide all the needs, not just one. And can we be a people that begins to say that we can think of Christian businesses, that we can think of, and I'm not, again, I want to be careful because I'm not talking about separation of secular and sacred as much as I'm saying the sacred invading the secular, you know, and changing it from the inside out. Let it be defined as a Christian business, not because they have a bunch of crosses or they have the Ten Commandments on a wall somewhere, but that the people live righteously and they take care of their workers and they honor one another. And I'm encouraged that Christian Care Ministry chooses to hold times of prayer and the staff is paid during those times. That is a celebration of, I want you to do your devotion. Like, we'll pay you during that time. We want you. I think that's it speaks of their priority, that they're financially involved in people taking time to calibrate their hearts in a time of Bible study. That's amazing. Why can't more of that be said? You know, I've heard of businessmen who offer single moms free daycare, you know, while they work for their companies, recognizing that some people don't have the support of you know, having someone to watch their kids, so they have a difficult time having a full-time job. And they're like, we'll do this. This will be part of your benefit package. You know, come work. Come be a part of this. I think there's something to be said about that. And so I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I encourage you guys to explore your heart and say, okay, God, what is my destiny? What is my purpose? Can I be, you know, eternally minded in doing this kind of stuff? What I'm involved in, am I seeing you exalted? Am I seeing others exalt you? And am I working towards that goal? Will you return and I'll have something to show and give you? And it's not about works, but faith without works is dead. And there's a reason that James says that. Like, there's a reason. Like, I'd imagine he saw that. He's like, guys, there's a balance here. You know, we live by faith, sure, and salvation comes through faith, but you are expected to do something, right? Like, you know, and the early apostles had decrees on how to handle orphans and widows and how those who were involved and uninvolved. It talks about men who do not work, don't eat bread. There's an expectation of going, hey, we don't want you to sit back. So my encouragement to you guys is just sort of that reengaging of going, okay, Lord, what have you asked of me? And how can I operate in that calling? And the recognition of just sort of what does that look like in terms of eternity? And again, I don't want to get into the specifics. That's going to look differently for each of you, obviously. And I'm not here saying heaven will have these jobs versus these jobs. But I am saying that I think there's a mindset or a backdrop that the early church had when speaking of eternity. Does that make sense? Did I scare anyone? Any questions or anything? Cool. All right, if you guys will stand up, I'd love to pray for you. Heavenly Father, we thank you that eternity is written on our hearts. We thank you, God, that our dreams and the vision you've instilled in us is not something that we've made up, but that you have a calling for each and every one of us, that you've given us each abilities. And Lord, may we find life in you being made manifest in those situations. May we find salvation, and may we find worship, and may we find the sharing of the gospel in all of our involvement of everything we do, regardless of what that might look like.